Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At Donald Trump's instruction, Elon Musk and his Doge team have been tearing through the federal government like a herd of buffalo on a stampede, firing employees, taking control of computer systems, closing agencies, and cutting funding for projects. But what happens in Washington doesn't just stay there. It has a nationwide, even worldwide, impact. Some of the changes in D.C. have had an immediate impact. Others may take longer to be felt. This is particularly true when it comes to scientific research funded by the federal government. That funding has played a pivotal role in advancing knowledge. It has driven innovation and fostered economic growth over time. That funding has enabled groundbreaking discoveries in medicine, technology, and environmental science, and allowed the United States to become a world leader in those areas. And not all of the work funded by those federal dollars is sequestered inside the Beltway. Most of it is not. It takes place at colleges and universities across the country. One of those universities is UNC Charlotte. They report they have had 15 federal grants terminated by the DOGE cuts. And today, we look at just one of those programs that will be impacted by the termination of a grant from the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Annalise Menicke, an associate professor of social work, and Dr. Jessamine Moxie, an associate professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Community Health, both at UNC Charlotte, had high hopes for a $469,000 grant they were awarded to study ways to improve the reactions that survivors of sexual violence receive when they disclose that experience to a friend. They have accepted our invitation to talk about the abrupt ending of funding for their research project, but to be clear, they are here representing themselves and their work, not UNC Charlotte. And we've also invited Dr. Chris Cooper to join us. He is a professor and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome. It's radio. You got to talk. Okay. Jessamine, I'm going to start with you. On your NIH grant, you are listed as the official project leader. So before we talk about the cancellation of funding and the ensuing legal moves to restore it, talk about your project. What exactly were you planning to accomplish with this $469,000 grant awarded to you by the National Institutes of Health?
We were taking a program that already existed, but had been developed really for cisgender, heterosexual college students, and we were making it fit and fit the realities of LGBTQ sexual violence survivors so that we would train people who were hearing about somebody else's experiences of sexual violence and respond more supportively. What we know is that when people talk about sexual violence, how it's received and the ways that people react really can change people's healing trajectories. So if someone isn't supportive or hits you with some of the same myths about LGBTQ people, it can really further exacerbate an already kind of precarious situation for many sexual violence survivors. So we were taking this program. We had 3 years where we were going to figure out what the LGBTQ community wanted to see from like kind of the changes of it. We were going to pilot that and conduct some feasibility trials with it.
And this was, I guess, to reiterate, the focus of this was to improve the reaction of the friends of survivors that the survivors would tell about their personal experience, because sometimes a reaction can influence the way that person who is the victim feels about themselves. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and to basically bolster a support network where it doesn't always exist. So a lot of the formal support, so if a LGBTQ sexual violence survivor is reporting, sometimes those entities aren't providing the right kinds of support or can kind of exacerbate things negatively. So yes, we're training some of those friends and other peers that we know that nearly all sexual violence survivors do tell a friend, a peer, or a partner. And so training those folks is really important.
And let me ask you this: your focus was going to be on the LGBTQ community, but would your findings have been applicable outside that community?
Absolutely. I think actually one of our main findings were that people were saying we want this to be more universal, partly because a lot of people aren't out, and so and or they might still be figuring out their identities. And so the changes that we were making were fitting a larger sort of span of different people's realities, different people's relationships, as well as taking into account a number of different myths that affect LGBTQ people, but affect others as well. It was updating the program.
Annalise, you worked for years, as I understand it, to get the money to finance this project. It took you 5 years of rejected applications, your words, and then a highly scrutinized review process by nationwide experts on this. Why? Is that normal to take to get 5 years to get approval? Were all of your applications to the same organization, the National Institutes of Health? How did your project change? Did it change to ultimately give you the money?
We started submitting in 2018 and we had five applications. This was our fifth one. All of them had gone to the National Institutes of Health, but we were kind of feeling out what was the most appropriate home within NIH. So we started submitting to National Institute of Child Health and Human Development or Minority Health Disparities, but ended up within the Institute of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse because there is a huge overlap between sexual violence, alcohol use, and particularly for LGBT folks. The process is the most rigorous in the country, and some would say in the world, of receiving these grants. There's less than 20% of grants that are submitted are actually awarded. And so it's very common to do this kind of revise and resubmit process. Not necessarily takes this long, but some people never get funded by the National Institutes of Health. And so it was a really big deal for us to finally receive this funding, and really represented us taking in the feedback from the reviewers, making modifications, and coming up with this project that was deemed to be scientifically rigorous, innovative, and important to the field.
So you finally got the money, you began the project, and then in March, you received a letter notifying you that your funding had been canceled. How far along were you in your work?
So we got the notice of award that started on May 1st of 2024, and then our grant was terminated on March 20th of 2025. So, we were about 9 or 10 months into the project, which meant Jess alluded to our initial findings. What we were able to do in that first 9 months was conduct focus groups, basically comprised of LGBT people, where we demonstrated the existing program and received their feedback on what modifications that they wanted to make it more inclusive. And we had just finished the focus groups, where we had 29 Charlotte residents participate in those focus groups. And we were beginning the analysis of that data when the grant was really abruptly terminated. So what that means is that the federal government spent this money to collect this data that now, without any additional support, we can't do anything with. And so that feels like a real betrayal to the people that we collected the data to. It feels like actual waste to not be able to do anything with these data. And there were really important insights that they provided that could make this program more effective.
Some of the programs that were terminated through these DOGE cuts involved clinical trials of medical things, drugs, etc. And I understand that if you stop those trials, sometimes can't you if you restart, you have to start from ground zero again. And many of the people participating in those drug trials, for instance, could be physically harmed because their treatment stops, period. You have collected information. Will that information wait for you to find new funding? Will it sit in a repository and still be valid should you restart this project?
Yeah, thankfully at this phase, if we found alternative funding to support the students who were helping us on that grant and to support the efforts of Dr. Moxie and I, we would be able to continue analyzing that data. And then we would need a significant amount of funding to go to the next phase of the intervention trial, which would be assessing whether the changes that we make actually are feasible and acceptable. And ultimately, our goal was to implement a randomized control trial where some people receive the revised intervention and some people don't. And none of that can happen without some funding to compensate the people who are involved.
So, Jessamine, this was expected to be a 3-year project. You were just a little under a third of the way through it. When it comes to projects like these, does the funding come to you in chunks? Does it come to you in a lump sum at the start, at the end? How does that work?
I would argue that it's a really convoluted sort of process, but we go through kind of a 1 year at a time process, as far as I'm aware, where we are getting reimbursed essentially from our expenses at the university. The university is getting reimbursed. And so it's made a little bit more complicated with some of this. We were doing a lot of right at the very end of the termination letter came in on March 20th. And so making sure that, students' hours right up until that point were kind of logged so that we could get that reimbursement. So no, it's not like the university is returning money. And that's the other part of this that feels for some of us a little bit black box-ish, is what happens to this funding that they're supposedly saving with the government. It's not like it's going back to citizens who have paid this money. This is tax funder money. It's not going back to that. So we're not, as far as I know, there hasn't been mention of what's going to happen with these funds that were allocated by the Congress that aren't being spent.
And Annalise, you have said that this cancellation is a, quote, real loss. You say that the Charlotte area is really a hub for the LGBTQ community, and they experience sexual violence at much higher rates than society at large. I think it would surprise people that you consider Charlotte to be a hub for the LGBTQ community. I'm curious how so, and why does that community experience sexual violence at a greater rate than the non-LGBTQ community?
Yeah, so when we think about Charlotte being a hub, it's really a product of being a big city in our kind of regional area, thinking about the other parts of North Carolina that are more rural, have less kind of large community organizations. And then also we have really great, fantastic community organizations that are kind of leading policy and direct services, such as Time Out Youth, Charlotte Trans Health Fund, and other places like that represent along kind of the 95 corridor. We are the biggest area that has LGBT specific youth and young adult services until Washington, D.C. So people from all around the area know that Charlotte is a place where you can come and receive affirming care regardless of your identity. And so that's really important. And the research has told us over and over again that LGBT folks are at higher risk of experiencing sexual violence. And that rate can be 2 to 3 times higher than cisgender and heterosexual people. And that's a product of many things. So being perceived as less than, being made to feel as if it is okay to enact these behaviors, being involved in more compromising, risky behaviors, et cetera.
Annalise Menicki is an associate professor of social work, and Dr. Jessamine Moxie is an associate professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Community Health at UNC Charlotte. And we'll hear from Dr. Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fallout from the cancellation of federal funds from the NIH and other organizations as a result of the DOGE cuts. research projects that are going on at universities and colleges all over the country, one of which is UNC Charlotte. We have two professors who were involved in such a project whose funding was canceled with us. They are here representing themselves and their work, and not the university itself, but they do work at UNC Charlotte. Annalise Meineke and Dr. Jessamine Moxie are with us, and Dr. Chris Cooper is also here. He's the professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. We'll get to Dr. Cooper in just a moment here. Jessamine, I want to talk about how this loss of fund, why you need this funding. Both of you are employed and paid by the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. You have some students who are assisting in this. So why is there a need for funding? If you don't need to buy chemicals, which you don't need to do because you're basically conducting research that's verbal and anecdotal and otherwise, why do you need $469,000 to conduct this research?
Yeah, so it's multifold. So the first aspect is that Dr. Meineke and I are involved in several different research projects, and so this isn't the only one. And we need some protected time to be able to actually focus on this project. The management of the grant itself, navigating the reporting requirements of NIH, doing the actual data collection, but really, most importantly, managing our team of students takes quite a bit of work. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But this, so being able to pay for someone else to teach some of our classes. UNC Charlotte has a like robust need for different instructors, and especially in my department, I'm needed in a lot of different areas. And so we need to pay other instructors to teach our classes. That's the first aspect. The other aspect is that our students need to pay their rent. And so they, we compensate them for their efforts and their time. This particular funding mechanism, this grant, was a grant that was focused on training new researchers. So getting more pipeline kind of career researchers trained up, getting students to see behind the scenes, what does it look like to do research? But most importantly, to see themselves in research, to know that this isn't something that just other people can do, that they can see themselves in it. So we had a team of six students working with us. And our students, almost all of them, work while they're going to school. And so to provide them with compensation, Dr. Meineke and I have a pretty firm belief that although there are many models where students volunteer to get experience, that that they need to be paid for their labor. And then there are other aspects of this project, such as using software for some of the data analysis, but also paying our participants. And we were gearing up for that randomized control trial. It involved nearly 200 people in that. And this is a climate where since so many of us are exhausted, so are our participants. We have a harder and harder time getting marginalized folks to show up for things. And so the incentives for research need to be not coercive, right? We have ethics review boards that really make sure that we're not doing that. But this is gone are the days where, especially for this project, where you can just pay $5, $10 for people to fill out a survey. What we were asking people to do was a focus group and to give meaningful impact, meaningful feedback on a project with marginalized folks, the incentives are there.
And for people who don't know, it has long been customary in conducting focus groups of any kind for any reason to pay the participants as an incentive and to feed them in some cases, and in many cases to hire a professional moderator who will be able to ask questions that don't taint the results of the answers. I'm just also curious about the students involved here. When your project was canceled, there are other kinds of impacts other than the loss of money. Will it have an impact on their future as students, as scientists? Will it impact their grades or the credits that they need to graduate?
Mike, this is one of the harder aspects. So, you know, we're doing this radio show and you have faculty, but you don't have the students in this conversation because this one of the bigger impacts that Dr. Meineke and I have been sort of shouldering a lot of is the fear. The students don't fully know what it looks like for them to try to speak about the impact of this grant on them. So I'll, you know, share some of what we know and But I think it's actually most indicative that their voices are not with us as we're speaking at rallies, as we're speaking on radio shows, because we cannot guarantee that their safety of their future careers won't be impacted. So short term, we are lucky enough that our institution has agreed to support our students through the end of the semester. But these were students who planned on working with us for a year or more, and they're trying to find other jobs, past May 9th when
I don't want to dwell on the fear aspect of it too much, but I do want to ask you, is this particular to the Trump administration, or is this something that would be a problem for any student who protests the cancellation of anything that they've been working on because it will brand them as a troublemaker in their field of study going forward?
I haven't seen fear like I've seen from faculty as well as students, in terms of our campus and what it looks like to speak out. The unpredictability of targeting and what will be sort of important and how you being a troublemaker is seen in sort of a changing landscape right now. So yes, I do think it's a key part of this administration
Dr.
and our
Maneky,
state.
one of the things that the Trump administration is wiping away is anything related to or associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And Donald Trump has said that there are only two sexes, male and female. Your project focused on the LGBTQ plus community. And in a letter from the NIH, it states that when your grant was awarded, you were told that any grant could be terminated if the award, quote, no longer effectuates the program goals or agency priorities. And it went on to say that was in fact the case. Quote, research programs based on gender identity are often unscientific, have little identifiable return on investment, and do nothing to enhance the health of many Americans. Many such studies ignore, rather than seriously examine, biological realities. It is the policy of NIH not to prioritize these research programs. That's a quote. Further, it mentions that NIH would normally suspend rather than immediately terminate grants to allow the recipient an opportunity to take corrective action, but states, quote, there is no corrective action possible here, and that the premise of this award is incompatible with agency priorities. What's your reaction to that wording?
Every time I read that or hear that, it's very painful. It's painful to live in a society where the mere inclusion of LGBT people is under attack. I think it's important to note that our grant was not specifically focused on trans folks, and it is important, and I believe in the value of grants that do that, but this one merely included, said that we were going to include trans people, and that is what got us terminated. Although the language of the termination notice will not explicitly say that, it says based on gender ideology, so I will admit that that is my guess of interpreting that. However, we know that trans people exist. They are in our community, they are in our society, and they have needs, and they are worthy of being included in research projects. And so, if science is terminated because we include a particular type of human, that is a very scary reality where people's identities become erased, and that can lead to dehumanization in many realms.
And I would guess it would be safe to say that future academics or academics applying for future grants will find ways to avoid using words that will trigger the Trump administration's rejection of their projects. But you can't, because that's what your project is about. You and other people who might be looking at this can't do that. And what's more, Jessamine, you told the WBTV that it was hard to read the termination notice because, quote, it is not true. Explain that.
I just thinking about the aspect of the research programs based on gender identity are often unscientific, is for many wonderful researchers who I work alongside, doing LGBTQ work, like gender identity as well as sex, which this administration does a terrible job of muddling, in terms of male and female being terms to indicate sex while leaving out intersex individuals. Like, the complexity of this just gets stripped, and we have wonderful researchers who have been doing really strong science to look at a variety of aspects around that, including some of the reasons why people who are gender diverse, trans and non-binary folks, have much stronger negative disparate outcomes. And so we need that research at a time where they're saying that it's unsafe. So it's simply just not true in that aspect of things.
Dr. Menicky.
Yeah, the other thing that I think is important to note is within that termination notice, there are six footnotes of citations, and there are zero in the paragraph that they say that we are being unscientific. So they don't even provide evidence to back up their own claims that we are being unscientific, because it simply cannot be true. Like, we know that trans people exist. This is not a uniquely American phenomenon. People who are gender diverse have existed across time, across geographies, and we are merely acknowledging that there is diversity within gender.
Dr. Chris Cooper is with us. He's with Western Carolina University, where he's the director of the Public Policy Institute and a professor of political science. Administrations change, Dr. Cooper, and with them so do policies and priorities. Is this anything more than that?
Yes, I think this is significantly more than that, right? I mean, certainly we expect to see changes across administrations, and administrations have every right to put in their own policies. But what we're talking about here is Congress had allocated money to fund a process that was existing before, and the Trump administration said, hey, because of the take care clause, right? This clause in the federal constitution that says we have to take care that laws be federally executed or faithfully executed, excuse me, that the executive branch should come in and just say, you know what, Congress, you said money's going to this. We disagree. We're pulling it. So this is fundamentally different. Look, there's always been members of Congress and executive branch folks and lots of people who criticize the way science is practiced, right? The National Science Foundation's come under attack for years about all sorts of things, right? What people are studying, how they're studying it. So some sort of knock on science and people looking at grants as normal to retroactively pull money out without any sort of specificity about the grant itself is definitely not normal. And some folks would argue not legal.
The termination letter from NIH, Chris, mentions that the premise of the original award is, quote, incompatible with agency priorities. Is it normal for those priorities to be set by a political agenda emanating from the White House, or is NIH and other agencies that hand out these grants for research generally, in the past at least, have they been insulated from politics?
I don't know that I would say they've been insulated from politics. Certainly the entire budget process is inherently political, right? So when they're going and asking for money, that's a political process. But the grants themselves, and again, once they have been awarded, that part, it's been treated as over. It's been treated as done, right? So even in the cases before, Jeff Flake, a U.S. senator from Arizona, every couple of years he would give a big talk about National Science Foundation, right? And he would cherry pick a couple of grants that he didn't think sounded good. There was one in particular a few years ago about what makes people run for Congress. And he said, we don't need to fund this with federal dollars. Never did he say, therefore, let's pull this grant in the middle of it being administered. He was using it as an example to make a change in the future. And so we have people, as we just heard, I think some pretty extraordinary testimony about how it's affecting the lives, yes, of researchers, but in some ways, with apologies to our two great researchers, that's the least important part here, right? We're talking about the students being affected. We're talking about our knowledge of what can actually help make us a better and more just, in some ways, society. So this is not normal. This is not something we've seen before. And I think we need to be very clear about that. This is not normal.
The American Public Health Association, of which Dr. Moxie and Dr. Menicky are both members, along with other entities and associations, have filed suit in district court in Massachusetts for a preliminary injunction against the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and its director, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And in that suit, the plaintiffs say that since Trump's executive order of January 20th, his first day in office, the federal government has, a quote, abandoned the scientific and medical approach to choosing what will be funded and instead targets for cancellation all programs that include DEI, woke gender ideology, and the Green New Deal. Could that, Dr. Cooper, legally be considered discriminatory?
And I guess we're going to find out, right? It's clearly a credible argument. The courts have a way of surprising us in either direction. So I'm certainly not going to predict what the courts are going to decide. But clearly, you've got a whole lot of smart folks who think that it's a reasonable case to make. And it seems on its face to be a reasonable case to make. So ultimately, we'll see what the courts do. We actually have seen the courts push back on the Trump administration, including some Republican judges. So it's not that this hasn't happened. Part of this may still be part of what the Trump administration wants. I think that uncertainty that Dr. Menicky and Moxie talked about before is in some ways what the Trump administration is trying to get as much as anything else, right? The idea that people might be scared or might not think it's a good investment to go into certain types of fields could be exactly the outcome they want. So I think we need to remember that. There's the legal outcome here, which may decide one thing, and then there is how people respond to this perceived new reality that is equally as important, but at least equally as important.
Your colleague, Dr. Susan Roberts, is a professor of political science at Davidson College, with whom you've appeared on this program many times, says, quote, campuses may be joining other universities in lawsuits, which may open a Pandora's box for Trump. We are seeing colleges and universities banding together on several fronts. And if you agree with Susan, what kind of a problem could this create for Trump and his efforts? And I have 30 seconds.
Yep. I almost always agree with Susan Roberts. This is no exception. I think this is a new political reality. Look, we've seen an increasing division in terms of whether somebody has a college degree or not. In other words, the new divide in American politics isn't as much about income. It's about whether you have a college education or do not. And I think the Trump administration knows that. And the Trump administration knows that going after colleges and universities is likely to appeal to their base and to push against the opposition. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
We're talking about the fallout of the cuts to projects around the country from federal funding cuts from the NIH and other sources, and we'll continue that conversation when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about the fallout of the cancellation of federal funding for various projects at colleges and universities around the country. UNC Charlotte has had 15 federal grants terminated, among them one for the project that we've been talking about this morning to study ways to improve the reactions that survivors of sexual violence receive when they disclose that fact, that experience, to a friend. The two researchers who were conducting that study, Dr. Annalise Menicky and Dr. Jessamyn Moxie, are with us representing themselves and their work and not the university. And we're also joined by Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Christy, the Atlantic magazine reports that, quote, in the past, if an NIH-funded clinical trial needed to halt, the agency could be counted on to provide money and support to ensure that the study's participants wouldn't take on further risk. But some people involved in clinical trials, for instance, for certain drugs, could be harmed if funding for those programs stops mid-treatment. And now, the Atlantic reports, the government is the one causing risk to patients well beyond what they signed up for. Could the government now be held liable for personal harm caused by ending these grants. Could that be part of the Pandora's box that Susan Roberts mentioned when I quoted her a few minutes ago?
Yeah, I think that is entirely possible. I mean, we have people who are going to be harmed by not continuing the clinical trials. We also have other types of harm, right? So when you get a grant like the kind we've been talking about today or other kinds of grants, there are obviously a ton of privacy related things that you need to take into account, right? To make sure that if somebody, for example, identifies as being gender non-binary, that information doesn't get out to somebody they don't want it to. Well, that stuff doesn't happen for free, right? And it doesn't happen on its own. We're talking about researchers who have to, as part of their protocols, make very clear how they want to keep this, you know, these identities private, these identities secret. Certainly, researchers are not going to just try to put this out there, but it costs money. It takes time to keep records a certain way, right? I mean, we're having these huge national conversations about members of the administration getting on Signal and why that's generally speaking a bad idea. Well, imagine all the data that researchers have that they are paying oftentimes through the grant for special kinds of software to keep that information private. Well, if you can't pay the money to keep that private anymore, what's going to happen to those data? So as I think we think about harm, the easy thing to think about, which is absolutely correct, is clinical trials where somebody's getting some sort of a treatment that then stops. But there's all sorts of other harms that can come if you just stop anything midstream.
We are living through what is, I think, can be adequately described as a revolution on all aspects of how the United States comports itself in the world and what the United States actually is. And it's all driven by one man and by his politics. I'm curious about the political aspect of this because Wednesday marks Donald Trump's first 100 days in office. His popularity has declined precipitously. He has the lowest popularity ratings and confidence ratings of any president in history. His approach to governance, his chaos, the decisions he's made have all come into question, and they have all played a role in that drop in popularity and public confidence in his abilities. Is there political support beyond his very small base for targeting not only gender ideology, but research surrounding gender or diversity and inclusion?
And I guess we're going to find out, right? I mean, I think there is a piece of this that many Americans will shrug about and think that it doesn't affect them. I don't think that's correct, right? I think the basic research affects us in a host of different ways. But there will be a shrug from folks, and I get that. If you are struggling to put food on the table, then the experiences of researchers at a university and the students they're supporting probably doesn't seem top of mind. So to me, the question is less about whether people will support this or whether they will make this part of their decisions in the future, right? Whether it is the kind of thing that folks pay attention to or just say that it's not worth my time. So it's less about the direction of the opinion, but more about whether people have one in the first place. And I think that's what we're trying to discover right now.
Dr. Menicke, in the suit to reinstate your grant and others, you accuse the government, your suit accuses the government of an unprecedented and ideologically driven purge of hundreds of projects. And you point out that the NIH was created by Congress 100 years ago and has become the primary research, the source of federal funding for biomedical and public health research in the country. Has funding for other projects under other administrations been terminated in the past because they don't conform to ideologically based policies? Have those entities, if that's the case, sued the government? Were they successful?
I'm not aware of anything like this. There have been instances where, in very rare circumstances, grants have been terminated, and those are usually associated with fraud or misconduct. It is unprecedented to have hundreds of grants cut for ideological reasons, and that's because the government is currently not following its own rules. There are rules against it acting in this way, and that's, you know, they're out of line and out of step with what they are, their own current policies are, procedures are, and stated strategic plans and ideologies. And so those cannot just change overnight. There are policies within NIH. Congress approved these funds already, and we have to follow the rules of this country in order for things to be continue happening in a way that is meaningful and equitable.
Chris, in their lawsuit, the plaintiffs here point out, and not just this, not just our two guests, this is involving other colleges, other projects, other universities around the country. In their lawsuit, the plaintiffs point out that the legal statutes set by Congress, quote, require NIH to increase recruitment of groups underrepresented in biomedical research, including racial minorities, women, and those from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. Do the reasons stated in the termination letter, part of which I read to UNC Charlotte for this project, which is about gender studies, does it appear, or not actually about LGBTQ studies, does it appear to fly in the face of those statutes?
Absolutely. And I think this is not limited to this specific case, right? There are a host of examples where universities, researchers, professors, administrators at universities are being asked to do things that run counter to what they've been told by the government before, what they are told by their accrediting bodies. And arouse there's an attack on accreditation, right? That could be a whole nother Charlotte Talks episode down the road. But I think many of us in higher education and people just interested in higher education are confused as to exactly what the rules are right now. And I think that may be part of a larger strategy. I think that may be exactly what the Trump administration wants. They think there's too much fraud, waste, and abuse in higher ed, and this is a way to get at it. But I think even, you know, as I was listening to the letter that you read, or part of the letter anyway, to these researchers, even as they're talking about their, quote, problems with the, quote, unscientific research on gender identity, the words they use are often in many, right? So often these kinds of projects that use gender identity, do them in an unscientific way. Many projects that do this, you know, handle it in a bad way. Even if we were to grant, which I would not, that these are true, that oftentimes research does this, there is nothing in the letter that I read or that I saw that actually talks about their project in particular, right? And I think, as Dr. Menicky talked about in a lot of detail, the process you have to go through to get approval of this kind of grant is really demonstrates that even if it were true that often this happens, it is not happening in this case, right? This is expert after expert after expert had to read this over the course of, I think they said, 5 years, five different submission processes. And so I think what we need to be asking for collectively is more specifics, right? It's one thing to wave your hand and say, often this kind of things happens. It's another thing to say, how does it affect this specific case?
This is one example of a much larger, a broader attack on colleges and universities and on education in general by MAGA and the Trump administration. And it's right out of the pages of Project 2025, a playbook written by the Heritage Foundation, which Donald Trump claimed to know nothing about, but is executing everything page by page as he goes through the first 100 days. He has signed executive orders targeting universities that he views as liberal adversaries to his political agenda. Some target all DEI efforts, other aspects of education that MAGA conservatives don't like. Trump has threatened colleges like Columbia University. Some have capitulated. Harvard, which has very deep pockets, is fighting back. Have we ever seen anything like this before, Christopher?
No. I think once again, this is unprecedented. Now, look, part, you know, people would say, have we seen attacks on higher ed? Of course we have. Have we seen people think that higher ed has too much waste? Absolutely, we've seen that, right? We see that in states and we see that with the federal government. But what we haven't seen is this kind of broad scale attack trying to pull money from a private organization like Harvard. I mean, it is even a different conversation when we talk about attacking a public institution versus a private institution, right? What we're seeing now is the private institutions like Columbia, like Harvard, like Yale, like Penn, by the way, the kinds of places that many people in the administration went to are the ones being attacked. And I think that is, the scale of this is very unusual. And I think your link to Project 2025 is a really pertinent one. David Graham, North Carolina resident, and who writes for The Atlantic, just had a book come out about Project 2025 and how we're seeing that play out in not just the higher education, but in terms of lots of things in the Trump administration. And I'm convinced from reading that book that this is a direct line, a direct link. You can decide for yourself if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I don't think anybody should deny that there is a link to what's in Project 2025 and how it's playing out today.
So Dr. Moxley, Harvard has deep pockets and the money to fight back, and not all schools do. Does UNC Charlotte have those deep pockets? Does the UNC system have those deep pockets, and would it be likely to dip into those deep pockets given the increasing amount of control over the university at large by the General Assembly, the Republican-controlled General Assembly?
I think that's the most salient part. I think it's not likely, given what we've seen, sort of the Board of Governors and indeed our legislators, sort of the way that they've been controlling the UNC system in ways that I don't think we've seen necessarily prior to the recent years. But no, I don't think that we have anywhere close to the deep pockets. I think that there's quite a bit of power from UNC Chapel Hill in terms of research punching power, and I think especially of NIH dollars. And I think certainly other institutions such as Duke have deep pockets and could be forming new coalitions, forming new kind of actions to push that way. But I don't know that, I think everybody's watching to see what Harvard will do and achieve. And then I think hopefully we will see other forms of mobilization, if not the same tactic.
Higher education in the United States, Dr. Menike, has been a crown jewel for this country for decades, for years, maybe a century or more. And whether these cuts come because of ideological differences or whether they simply come out of a desire to save money, no matter how small or how large that money is, what's at stake here? What might the consequences be, not just with your research project, but all of these research projects coming to an end because of these budget cuts? What might it do to our standing in the world and our ability to compete?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can kind of talk it through what it means for this project as an example. So our project was aimed at improving the healing trajectory of LGBTQ plus survivors of sexual violence. If we aren't able to meet their needs, that community will be less healthy, which means our community will be less healthy. And that will be more expensive in the long run. We know that prevention works and is less expensive than large scale emergency interventions in the long run. But also NIH, you know, it's an institution that does research. They have researched what are the economic impacts and returns of receiving federal funding. And they have demonstrated that for every $1 invested in NIH funds, there is a $2.54 return. So that means for our local economy, this represents over $1 million in losses. And our grant was funding salaries, not just our students, not just the faculty, but they had staff on the grant. It all comes back to our community. And that's just one of the 15 that are cut here, of the hundreds that are cut in North Carolina and even broader. So there's health impacts, there's economic impacts, and then there is this pipeline. We know from watching what has happened in the world of gun violence, there was a 20-year moratorium on research and gun violence, and now the United States is the leader in gun violence. And so we know what's going to happen. We know what the end of this is, and it's really tragic that we are choosing that path that will harm everybody in America.
Dr. Moxley.
The other thing that I'll name is that as a LGBTQ person myself, I identify as bisexual, that we're seeing not just amongst sort of my community of other queer folks, but in general, a lot of folks in higher ed who are looking at international jobs. We're experiencing a possible brain drain as people either feel persecuted or they feel like they can't do the research that they are like designed and meant to do. I think many of us in higher ed, we're not just doing this as a job. We're doing this because we deeply care about this. And so people are willing to leave the country in order to do the work without having this type of censorship upon them.
Which is also unprecedented, as so many other things are in this country. The rubber will meet the road, I suppose, when the money hits the local governments, the money that you alluded to, Dr. Menicky, a moment ago, the loss of that funding, because CMS is losing more than $4 million in one federal grant for teacher development. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has been severely impacted with the loss of more than $200 million, much of it passed on to local health departments and social services to help toward immunization efforts, infectious disease monitoring, substance abuse disorder services, and more. So it will take a long time for this likely to filter down to people so that they recognize what the impact actually is. Dr. Annalise Menicky and Dr. Jessamyn Moxie, both with UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.